chapter of Daniel. And we were right in the very midst of the history that related to the kings of Syria and the kings of Egypt. And the king that we currently had under discussion was Antiochus Epiphanes, who we started reading about in the 21st verse. And he was the king of Syria. And he just come in now to the kingdom and taken power. We'll go back and begin reading with that 21st verse. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom of flatteries. Now that's this Antiochus Epiphanes. He's called here a vile person. They didn't give him the honor of the kingdom, but he usurped it and took it by underhanded means. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overthrown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. Now this is still the same man we're talking about. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. Now this is speaking of him and his opposition to the kingdom of the south, which would be Egypt. Now beginning in the 25th verse, and until we get down to verse 31, we're going to be dealing now with this period of history that was between the Old Testament and New Testament era, the period that was in which Egypt and Syria were these main powers. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Now the king of the south was Ptolemy Philometor. He was the son of Cleopatra, we were talking about last time. And his power was inferior now to the king of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes. Mr. Clark says that Antiochus marched against Ptolemy, the king of the south, Egypt, with a great army, and the Egyptian generals had raised a mighty force. Stirred up to battle, the two armies met between Pelusium and Mount Caseus. But he could not stand, that is, the king of the south could not stand. The Egyptian army was defeated. The next campaign, he had greater success. He routed the Egyptian army, took Memphis, and made himself master of all Egypt except Alexandria. And then the people of Alexandria, they decided that they would take the kingdom away from of Alexandria, away from Ptolemy, and they gave it to his brother. Now in verse 26, yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall down slain. Now that's talking about the king of the south. This is the proof of what has been last noted, that the intrigues of Antiochus, corrupting the ministers and officers of Ptolemy, were the cause of all the disasters that fell on the Egyptian king. They that fed on the portion of his meat, who were in his confidence and pay and possessed the secrets of the state, betrayed him. And these were the means of destroying him and his army, so that he was defeated, as was before observed. Verse 27, and both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Now what happened, this king of the north, Antiochus Epiphanes, he would meet with Ptolemy, the king of the south, and there's a record in which they would eat at the same table, and they would pretend that they were making an agreement with each other, a covenant with each other, and really what they were doing was trying to deceive and to treacherously deal with each other. And so it says that the heart shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, which they actually did. This came to pass, and when they were treacherously dealing with each other, but it shall not prosper. That is, the motives of each one did not materialize as they thought it would. It did not prosper. For yet the end shall be at the time appointed. That is, in order for what each one had in mind occurred, it would have brought about things before or time that prophecy wanted that it would happen. Then shall he return to his land with great riches. This is Epiphanes. And his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Antiochus did return, laden with riches from the spoils that he took in Egypt. And hearing that there had been a report of his death, at which the citizens of Jerusalem had made great rejoicings, verse 28 says, his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant. Now, that would be, of course, against the temple, against the worship of the temple, and against the order that God's people had given them by the covenant. He was determined to take a severe revenge, and he had an ostensible pretext for it, for Jason, who had been deprived of the high priesthood, hearing the report of the death of Antiochus, raised forces, marched against Jerusalem, took it, and obliged Menelaus, the high priest, to shut himself up in the castle. Antiochus brought a great army against Jerusalem, took it by storm, slew 40,000 of the inhabitants, sold as many more for slaves, boiled swine's flesh, and sprinkled the temple and the altar with the broth, broke into the Holy of Holies, took away the golden vessels and other sacred treasures to the value of 1,800 talents, and restored Menelaus to his office, and made one Philip, a Phrygian, governor of Judea. Now, this action here seems to be the thing that is referred to as a desolation of the temple and a stopping of the daily sacrifice. Now, this occurred with Antiochus Epiphanes, but it also occurred in a greater sense in A.D. 70 after, of course, the church had been established and the temple was again destroyed by Titus. So we're going to have the discussion now of the greater and the lesser fulfillment of this thing of taking away the daily sacrifice and then bringing in the abomination of desolation. But this event right here is one of the times that it could be referred to as the abomination of desolation. By boiling this swine's flesh and sprinkling the temple and the altar with the broth, that certainly was an abomination because a swine was considered to be an unclean animal and certainly not to have been put on the temple or the altar in any sense, but he did this to profane the temple. And he shall do exploits and return to his own land. Well, that's what this includes here. Verse 29, at the time appointed he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. Now, there was a little later from this time he went back into the south, back into Egypt, and again with the purpose of going down to conquer, but this scripture says, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. It won't be like the other times that he went down there. It was going to be different with him this time. Verse 30, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Now this word Chittim is generally regarded to be the Roman power. And so he says, the ships of the Roman power shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved, and return, and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. Now let's read just for a moment what actually did historically happen at this time. Mr. Clark says that Chittim is well known to mean the Roman Empire. Antiochus, being now in full march to besiege Alexandria, and within 7 miles of that city, heard that ships were arrived there from Rome with legates from the Senate. He went to salute them. They delivered to him the letters of the Senate, in which he was commanded, on pain of the displeasure of the Roman people, to put an end to the war against his nephews. In other words, these ships brought the message to him that he was to stop the war. Just a command from the Roman government to stop this war, and stop this dealing in the way it was with his nephews, one over Alexandria and one over the rest of Egypt. Antiochus said he would go and consult his friends, on which Populus, one of the delegates, took his staff and instantly drew a circle around Antiochus on the sand where he stood and commanded him not to pass that circle till he had given a definitive answer. Antiochus, intimidated, said he would do whatever the Senate enjoined, and a few days after began his march and returned to Syria. And then Mr. Clark named 7 authors that confirm that this is actually what happened in history. So it fits perfectly with what the prophecy said, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. He shall be grieved. Polybus says that he was grieving and groaning, both mortified, humbled, and disappointed. Now, on the part about having indignation against the Holy Covenant, he vented his rage against the Jews and sent his general, Apollonius, with 22,000 men against Jerusalem, plundered and set fire to the city, pulled down the houses round about it, slew much of the people, and built a castle on an eminence that commanded the temple, and slew multitudes of the poor people who had come up to worship, polluted every place, so that the temple service was totally abandoned, and all the people fled from the city. Now, if the other event wasn't an abomination of the holy place, certainly this one was. And when he returned to Antioch, he published a decree that all should conform to the Grecian worship, and the Jewish worship was totally abrogated, and the temple itself consecrated to Juniper Olympus. How great must the wickedness of the people have been when God could tolerate this? Now, verse 30 further says, so shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. In transacting these matters, he had intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. That is, with wicked Millenius, the high priest, and the apostate Jews united with him, who gave from time to time such information to Antiochus as excited him against Jerusalem, the temple, and the people. Now, Mr. Clark quotes from another man that he calls Bishop Newton here at this point. He says, it may be proper to stand a little here and reflect how particular and circumstantial this prophecy is concerning Egypt and Syria from the death of Alexander to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. There is not so concise, comprehensive, and regular an account of their kings and affairs to be found in any authors of those times. The prophecy is really more perfect than any history, and is so wonderfully exact, not only as to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, but likewise equally so beyond that time, that we may conclude in the words of the inspired writer, no one could thus declare the times and the seasons, but he who hath them in his own power. And it is remarkable that all of these events fit just letter perfect to the things that are said here about those kings. To me, it's a pretty dry period of history, unless you're really a history buff and interested in what these kings did in their wars with each other. But this was a time now between the Old and New Testaments. It was a time in which this directly involved God's people in Palestine, because they were between these two powers of Syria and Egypt. And so the things that happened here directly affected God's people. And in particular, God was concerned about this corruption of the temple, and the prophecy about it was an important thing to these people. Now in verse 31, we take a little different turn now. We begin now after Christ, after the New Testament had come into effect. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. Now this word arms here indicates the Romans. After Antiochus, arms, that is the Romans, shall stand up. For arms in this prophecy everywhere denote military power and standing up, the power in activity and conquering. Hitherto, Daniel had described the action of the kings of the north and of the south, that of the kings of Syria and Egypt, but upon the conquest of Macedon by the Romans, he has left off describing the actions of the Greeks and begun to describe those of the Romans in Greece who conquered Macedon, Illyricum, and Epirus in the year of the era of Nebuchadnezzar, 580. I don't know what year 580 is because I don't know who this Nebuchadnezzar was. None of my other books say anything about it, and Mr. Clark wrote it at a time apparently when it was common knowledge, but I don't know when this was. But it was really about 140 or 5 or 150 or so B.C. that the Romans began to get their power. One calculation takes it back to 159 B.C., and another calculation takes it back to about 145 B.C. Now he tells some of these events. 35 years after, by the will of Attalus, they inherited all Asia, westward of Mount Tarius. 65 years after, they conquered the kingdom of Syria and reduced it to a province. And 34 years after, they did the same to Egypt. By all these steps, the Roman arm stood up over the Greeks, and after 95 years more, by making war upon the Jews, they polluted the sanctuary of strength, the temple, so called by reason of its fortifications, and took away the daily sacrifice, and placed the abomination that maketh desolate, or of the desolator. For that this abomination was thus placed after the time of Christ, appeared from Matthew 24:15. Now I would like to turn here just a minute and read Matthew 24:15, in which he seems to make a direct reference to this, and that is one of the main points that we have to use as a reference as to the time, as to when this happened. And we're going to really get in some very, very difficult explaining of times in this next chapter, in the 12th chapter of Daniel. It's a short chapter, but it has some times that are almost impossible to really reconcile with each other and to give an explanation of. But in Matthew 24:15, Jesus is talking about the destruction of the temple, and he makes this statement, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand, then let them be which be in Judea flee, and let him which is not come down to take anything out of his, neither let him which is in the flesh take his clothes, unto them that are with child unto them in those days. But flight be not in the winter, neither on the day, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." Now, it's very possible that the statement made by Jesus here was the very first time that there was really a plain explanation as to just when this was to be. And so we know then that it had to be after the time of Christ, because Jesus refers, he says, "The abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place." This tells us not only that this was after the time of Christ, but it also tells us that Jesus himself recognized the book of Daniel as being an inspired book, and he referred back to it as a factual reference. So this is the Roman power that did take away the daily sacrifice. Now Antiochus Epiphanes did the same thing, which was a lesser fulfillment. But now we're blending into the greater fulfillment. We know that it has to be referring to after the time of Christ also, because Christ referred back to this very passage of Scripture. Now we're going to have some other references to this abomination that maketh desolate. And it's quite possible that there's more than just one or two fulfillments of this. There may be a repeated numbers of fulfillments of this. Not only could it apply to the temple and the destruction of the worship of the temple, but it could also apply to the falling away of the church in some manner, this abomination of desolation, in which there was no historical reference to a true Christian during the long period of time, in which the church had to flee into hiding and be covered up by the earth. It could also refer to the time in which the Mohammedans invaded and captured Jerusalem and kept it for some 1260 years, from the 7th to the 20th century. Wasn't taken out of their hold until around 1917. So there are a lot of greater and lesser fulfillments that this could apply to. And it's difficult to appreciate the problem until we get over into the next chapter and start trying to apply some of those times that he gives there. But now, these next few verses are very fascinating and very applicable verses to us, especially since we've just finished the study of the book of Revelation. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. Now, what are we talking about? We're talking about the Roman Empire. We're talking about the power that went with the Roman Empire. Now, you remember this, the corrupt and apostate church rode on the wings of the political Roman power, on the back of this beast, so to speak. So one depended upon the other. Well, he says that, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. This is understood of the Christian Jews, for the new had now succeeded to the old, the whole of the Jewish ritual having been abolished, and Jerusalem filled with heathen temples. And he, the Roman power, did all he could by flatteries as well as threats to corrupt the Christians and cause them to sacrifice to the statues of the emperors. They did all that they could now to entice these Christians to give up the truth and to pollute it or to dilute it or to compromise it with their wicked ways. And we see this is exactly what happened to the Roman church. The Roman church incorporated the heathenistic practices into their doctrine and into their rituals so that it looked like that they originated as Christian practice, and really they weren't. And so by the heathen, by making these things look good and enticing, the Romans took them. They were flattered to be able to take them in. And they, let's see, but, they're still in verse 32, the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Now the people that really know God, these would be the genuine Christians, they shall be strong, that is, they'll be strengthened by his grace and spirit, and to do exploits could mean that they would continue steadfast in all temptations, hold fast their faith, and enjoy a good conscience. The deeds that they did weren't just passive deeds. They didn't just sit back and fold their arms and sit and watch history go by, but they had to be active in the maintaining of the purity of their faith. So they had to do something. And he calls it here, shall do exploits. Verse 33, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many. Now, they that understand, these would have to be, of course, the apostles and the prophets and the evangelists and the pastors and the teachers, and any Christian could be counted among those that understand if he's a genuine Christian. They that understand among the people shall instruct many. their duty and their activity would include the instructing of men. They spread this gospel. It's not just held in a little corner someplace, but they do all that they can to proclaim and to spread the good news. Yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by spoil many days. They were exposed to the malice and the fury of their enemies. And some of the scholars have shown where that they had 10 state persecutions given by the Roman power, and they suffered all kinds of tortures with but little intermission for some 300-year period. Now, as we study through Revelation, we get all of these, and the four horses and those ten seals that are opened up, seven seals that are opened up. Verse 34. Now when they shall fall, they shall be hoping with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. Now when they shall fall, now that is, this would be the actual fall of the church, that is the doing away of the faithful order. Those that were strong and did understand and that did spread the gospel, eventually they were overcome and there just seemed to be none of them left. But he says when this happens, they shall be hoping with a little help. And this seems to be the rise of Constantine. Constantine, you know, was very, very sympathetic toward the Christian cause. He eventually got laws passed so that a person could worship any way that he wanted to. And great favor was given to anyone who wanted to worship as a Christian. There was no restraint put into his place. And even in the end, Constantine himself claimed to be a Christian. I understand he was baptized just shortly before his death. But whether he was truly a Christian or not is beside the point. He did give help to the Christian cause. And it was because of this that he actually then allowed the Roman Catholic power to be joined in with the Roman political power, and the two then became joined together as one in most of their exploits. Mr. Clark says, by Constantine, who while he removed all persecution and promoted the temporal prosperity of the Christian church, yet added little to its spiritual perfection and strength. For many, now seeing the Christians in prosperity, cleaved to them with flatteries. That is, became Christians simply because the emperor was such. And that's what our verse 33 says. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. It became such a popular thing. It became such a politically motivated and profitable thing to be and to claim to be a Christian. Until now, many would cleave to them with flatteries. Everybody claimed to be a Christian. That was the popular thing to do. That was the popular way to go, the popular cause. Except this form of Christianity was polluted so that it was not acceptable to God. It was an abomination. It was brought on by what is described in Revelation as the mother of harlots, and actually looked upon as the great Babylon. And we'll find today that whenever people start wanting to come into an organization that claims to be the church for other reasons besides the salvation of their soul, they're there because of family influence, they're there because of political pressure, or because of some kind of prestige point, it's a social club or whatever, then we're going to find corruption in the church, and that place will cease to be the church for very long, if it were indeed in the beginning. So many shall cleave to them with flatteries. Now verse 35, and some of them of understanding shall fall. Now, there are two or three ways you can look at this verse, but one that seems to be plausible to me is that some of those who claim, or rather who do actually understand, who have the truth, they shall fall. That is, they're going to be overcome. They're going to be caused to be trampled down, so to speak. To try them, and to purge, and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time of...